The XX Gab Fest is sponsored by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audiblepodcast.com/XX.
Hello, and welcome to the XX Gab Fest for Thursday, August 22nd, the female, gay, Mike Bloomberg edition. I'm Allison Benedict, editor of XX, filling in for Hannah Rosen, who is on vacation this week, but actually will be calling in for a segment later, so stay tuned. I'm joined in the New York studio by Noreen Malone, staff writer at The New Republic. Hey, Noreen.
Hey, Allison.
And Slate's June Thomas, editor of Slate's soon-to-debut LGBT blog, Outward.
Hey, Allison.
Hey, June. Okay, so today we're going to talk about the Netflix series Orange is the New Black, and specifically about criticism of the show for exploiting black women and leaning on ethnic stereotypes. We'll also talk about New York mayoral candidate Christine Quinn, who, if elected, would be the first female and openly gay mayor of New York City. And finally, we'll call Hannah on the road with her children and husband in the car, I think, to talk about her latest Atlantic piece, Murder by Craigslist, about a serial killer who targeted a new vulnerable class of victim, unemployed white working class men. But before we get into any of that, two announcements. First, a quick plug for our upcoming live GabFest on September 18th at George Mason University's Center for the Study of Gender and Conflict in Arlington, Virginia. Hannah will be there, Noreen will be there, and frequent GabFest guest star Dan Coyce will be there. So you should be there, too, if you live in the area. To get more info and purchase tickets, check out our Facebook page, facebook.com/XXMag, or go to slate.com, where on the left-hand rail there's a yellow event section called Up Next that will direct you to a ticket buying page. And there are still some tickets available, so get them. The second announcement is more exciting. I mean, the live show is very exciting. But the second announcement is the awesome news that June, sitting across from me wearing horizontal striped pants.
Horizontal seersucker. Very
horizontal
special.
Seersucker. Will now be a regular on the GabFest, taking over for yours truly. We will have a ceremonial passing of the mic after the show.
And we'll weep together.
Correct. There'll be animal sacrifice. Noreen brought incense. But for now, let me just say that, of course, I'll miss gabbing with you guys, but the GabFest is really lucky to have June. So hooray, June.
Hooray, Allison.
Okay, so let's talk about Orange is the New Black, the very popular Netflix series about life inside a federal women's prison as seen through the eyes of a privileged blonde straight white woman, Piper, who's doing time for a crime she committed 10 years prior. On the outside, she makes artisanal soaps to sell in Barney's. A recent piece on the show by Aura Bogato at The Nation, headlined White is the New White, started out like this. Slave narratives became most fashionable among abolitionist circles in the mid-19th century. These narratives remain deeply powerful, yet each one is framed by a white introduction, which authenticates the black experience. The white practice of verifying the lives of black fugitives who were skillfully plotting their own liberation has changed in circumstance and in medium, but the role of white people at its center has not. Today, its latest manifestation is playing out in the Netflix hit series Orange is the New Black. So, June, is this criticism fair?
Well, I mean, it's her point of view. It's not for me to deny it. I understand where she's coming from. But I guess I don't see Orange is the New Black this way. I certainly don't think that just because women of color are in a show that that's enough. And so, you know, hey, so what do you want? That's not my point of view. I certainly am feeling okay to have like a version of the Bechdel test for people of color. Like, just as the Bechdel test says you have to have at least two named women who talk to each other about something besides men, why not a test that says you have to have at least two named people of color talk to each other about something besides white people, women of color, white women. But I happen to think that Orange is the New Black is six kinds of awesome. And I think that although it's very true that it is framed through the, the entry character is this white woman, Piper,
who we should say is a real person.
Exactly.
Who wrote a memoir.
Yeah, and the book is the TV show is based on a book that she wrote, a memoir of her time in jail. And I have to say, having read the book after watching the TV show, I just thought the TV show was an amazing achievement of dramatization. The book has an agenda. You know, it's a rehabilitation narrative, or as our old friend Jess Gross called it, a middle class transgression memoir. And that's absolutely right on. You know, that's her agenda in there, and she's very kind of careful and so on. The TV show did an amazing job of finding narratives, really dramatizing interesting stories without exploiting them, and in fact had what might be considered a meta-narrative of Piper's. I mean, you said she's a straight woman. She's straight at this point. She's got a male fiancé when she goes into jail, but she actually has a past as a lesbian or so. You know, we could call her queer. But there's a story where her fiancé essentially exploits the women of color and the poor women and the lesbians in the prison. And it's almost like that felt like a real meta commentary and a very knowing commentary. And I just don't think that the show does that. I think it's achieved amazing things. You know, we've seen discussions of what prison's really like in several magazines. Kerman wrote an op-ed for the New York Times that was, I thought, very powerful, that she had that platform because of the show. And so I just, although I completely understand where Al Rubagado is coming from, I guess I just feel like this show meets the test. It's not a slave narrative. She's an entry character, and that's a typical thing that we see in television. Doesn't excuse it, but that's just how television works.
Yeah, and there's even an early episode, I think maybe the first or the second, where Piper is shocked when someone says, "Oh, they're going to put you with like the other
in
white
the ghetto
people, in the ghetto." Or no, it's before they send her to the ghetto, which is where what the inmates themselves call the place where all the black people room. One of the white women says early on, "Oh, like we take care of our own kind," and Piper looks incredibly shocked. And the woman goes, "It's not racist; it's tribal." and it in that moment it felt anthropological to me because I mean she did go to prison. Like I haven't done time.
no, Maureen, so hard.
Can't totally fact check this, but it you know that sort of that makes sense to me. People operate in the real world in ways that are tribal, that we might, you know, if we were constructing an after-school special on, like, a perfect post-racial prison, it wouldn't look like the one in Orange is the New Black, but that is not what it was meant to be.
I think the Nation writer, and I don't agree with her, I agree with you guys, but I think she would say that her problem isn't about accuracy, that she's not, you know, I didn't feel like she was making the argument that this is an inaccurate portrayal of these black women or how prisoner works, but just mainly that, like, a white woman is making money off of this.
And I have to say, I did have some discomfort around that myself. You know, I know that when Kernman wrote her book, there was some provision for money going to, you know, some fund for that helps women who've either served time or in jail. But, you know, yeah, that's a reasonable point of view, but she also referred to wildly racist tropes, which I didn't see. And, you know, we have come from different life experiences, but it was a remarkable achievement in really kind of its entertainment. It's got people watching it really thinking about what goes on in prison. Is it real? All of these issues that seem totally fascinating that wouldn't have sparked otherwise, I think.
And the racist trope is, you know, like she talks about how one of the black women is called a monkey, but the show is not calling the black woman a monkey. It's a racist white prison worker, which actually seems like the opposite of that, right?
Yeah. So I am going to reach deep into my American studies undergraduate education and say that this actually strikes me not so much as a slave narrative, as a captivity narrative, which is, you know, when the main figure is captured by an enemy who she considers uncivilized. Mm. And so the way I see the show, the enemy is like the penal system and the guards are the sort of uncivilized forces, and or like, you know, the budget cuts are an uncivilizing force. Like, it wasn't so much white people enslaving people of another race. It was just like, these women are all captured and this is their story.
That's very convincing to me. It's interesting, too, that the guards, I guess there are some women, but they're mostly white men. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is at least one black male guard, but I don't think he has any lines. I mean, it is very much the construction of the story. And let's just take a moment. I know, you know, others, I think the Culture Gabfest talked about the show as a, you know, a cultural icon. But let's just take a moment to say that this show has really found some amazing actors
yes.
who I'm sure will be getting some roles now who probably wouldn't have before because they didn't get that exposure. I mean, we've seen that The Wire didn't necessarily guarantee that these amazing black actors then had the careers that they deserve. But Uzo Aduba, who plays Crazy Eyes, Suzanne, I saw her at LA at the Television Critics Association gathering where there are many, many stars. I can honestly say she was the one that people were most excited about. And she was actually there by chance.
She's so charismatic. Like, her character is so creepy and stalkerish, but in a, like, you can't take your eyes off of her way.
And her arc, I know you guys have some episodes still to come. Her arc is one of the most moving and just incredible. You know, she gets to do some serious acting, and that is fabulous. You know, Jenji Cohen, who made this show, is also responsible for Weeds. And I
right.
think in that show, you see a lot of the kind of precursor elements to what later comes up in Orange is the New Black. And I have to say that I might be more sort of sympathetic to Bogado's viewpoint there, because that was often the case that, you know, the main character in Weeds would, because she was involved in the drug trade, would find herself working with black women, with Latinos. And that was not always very well
yeah.
handled. But I feel like Cohen has learned a lot from that experience. And I just thought this is an amazing work.
It's just so funny. I don't think we've said that enough,
yeah.
but I think that's a saving grace. Like, this essay wants it to be a lot more serious than it is, I think. And it's pretty, I mean, humor is not always 100% politically correct. I don't think this is especially politically incorrect, but
prison is not especially politically correct, one would imagine.
Exactly. I mean, there's one scene I keep thinking about, which is early in the season, there is one woman, a Latina woman, who is sort of falling in love with one of the prison guards, and he's falling in love with her. And they have this moment where he gives her chewing tobacco to chew, and she gets it stuck in her teeth, and he picks it out of her teeth with the point of her earring, and that's like totally disgusting, but it's this real romantic moment, and it's half funny and it's half sweet, and I think that's like just sort of encapsulates what the series is trying to do more than anything.
And straddling all the tones is really hard, and they do it really well there. I mean, I think there were a couple of moments when I thought, but not too many.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things that Aru Bogado says is there should be a TV show about Assata Shakur. Well, yeah, there should be. Just because
right.
this, you know, I think we'll see many more. Television is a copycat medium. I hope that we will see, because of this, many more shows focusing on both women of color, and lesbians. There's some amazing girl-on-girl action in the show, too. And I don't see that there can be anything bad about this.
I'm with you.
Awesome.
Okay, we all agree. How strange.
Yeah.
Okay, before we move on to our second topic, I want to thank our loyal sponsor, Audible.com, the leading provider of premium digital spoken audio information. Audible has 100,000 audiobooks, podcasts, radio shows, and all sorts of great things to listen to that we can all download to our various devices, including whatever device you are listening to us on right now. For XX listeners who aren't already Audible members, you get a free audiobook of your choice when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audiblepodcasts.com/XX. Since we're talking about Christine Quinn next, I'm going to recommend on Audible a biography of our outgoing mayor, Joyce Pernick's Mike Bloomberg, Money, Power, Politics. It came out in 2009, just as Bloomberg was running for his controversial third term. I'm sure another book will be written, or many books will be written, about Bloomberg in the coming year or two. But for now, this is the most comprehensive biography available. And regardless of what you think of Mike, worth a listen. Okay, let's move on to Christine Quinn. After the implosion of the Anthony Weiner campaign, conventional wisdom said that Christine Quinn, current city council speaker, would sail to the Democratic nomination for New York mayor, making history along the way as a woman and an out lesbian. This is, however, not exactly happening. Recent polls show Quinn in a tight race with other Democratic candidates, though not Weiner, we should say, and public support has yet to coalesce around her. A recent New York Daily News piece talked about how little the lesbian super PAC, LPAC, has done to support Quinn's campaign, and Slate's Katie Roifey recently wrote a column asking why more women aren't excited by her. So, Noreen, why aren't identity politics working for Christine Quinn?
Well, I think it's a somewhat complicated answer. I think one reason is that it's can feel a little insulting to women to be appealed to only on identity politics. I think they are working for her to a degree. I think she has a lot of support in the LGBTQ community. But, you know, the office of New York City mayor is not quite the same symbolic one that, say, president is. So I don't think that, you know, calling hers a historic candidacy does quite the same work for her that it did for Obama or Hillary, for instance. The other thing is that just a lot of women feel like Quinn is not quite as good on issues that matter to women. There was a big controversy today. Bill de Blasio's wife.
Bill de Blasio, who's basically neck and neck with her
yes,
in first place.
And is sort of the progressive candidate. And Quinn is more the continuing the Bloomberg establishment candidate. I think that's sort of a fair.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Fair. anyway, in Maureen Dowd's column this morning, Bill de Blasio's wife was quoted saying something to the effect that Christine Quinn sort of doesn't understand you know, the concerns of mothers and families, and she caught a lot of flack for that. And also, now it seems like Maureen Dowd might have taken that line out of context. But I think the sentiment is one that you are going to see people raise against Quinn, that you know, she's more concerned with business development than things that are maybe more readily thought of as, for instance, women's issues.
Well, that was also taken kind of as a slight because she doesn't have... She's a lesbian without
yes,
children.
Yes, it was
right?
a very fraught thing to say.
Yeah.
What do you think, June? Are you...
It seems very clear to me that she's not doing very well because of homophobia.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh,
whoa,
interesting. Okay.
Oh, wow. Saddle up.
June.
Saddle up.
It seems to me, okay, she is a centrist and New York is a liberal town, but we have had a guy who started as a Republican for three terms, and it's not like she's in the middle of this field of superstars. It's a field of mediocrity, and even if she's not the brightest star in the firmament, I would say her wattage is greater than these other dudes. And it just seems to me that it's a combination of homophobia, of sort of making her into the other in a way that I don't really know why they would, because she's very, very conventional in many ways. She just happens to be married to a woman instead of a dude. And, you know, I can find no other reason. These other candidates are not superstars. They're also rans. And it just seems to me that she's by far the best candidate. And do you feel any tribal affiliation with her as a fellow Irish-American?
Well, I will say that I read – I do feel some tribal affiliation with her. I read there was a great profile of her in New York in the springtime where they, you know, sort of make, like, broad characterizations of, like, brassy Irish women and, like, you know, a certain kind of Irish family. And I love that. However
– You were like, yes!
You know, I was into that. But I would not characterize the case against Quinn as having anything to do with homophobia. Maybe, again, I'm not gay, so I don't, you know, I probably experience New York differently than you do, but I don't think that it's a particularly homophobic place in the great scheme
no,
of things.
No, of course not. No. By no means.
But also, I mean, the knock against Quinn, I think, has a lot to do with her specific ties to Bloomberg on the term limit extension.
Right.
This is for people at home who don't live in New York. This might not be totally interesting, but basically she allowed Bloomberg to get a third term, and she sort of forced city council into allowing that. They all voted to extend their own term limits, but then banned any term limit extension for the future. And also people who voted against it, there was some real retribution against them in terms of cutting off funds to their offices to their districts.
And she was thought to have done that to gain Bloomberg's endorsement.
Exactly, like a very, very calculated political move. And you know, and the rap on her, which I think is probably deserved, is that is a somewhat typical, not typical, but that is not was not a surprising thing for her to do.
Right, she's a politician.
Right, she's a politician. But I think like that got enough publicity that. And I think also, right, people, I mean, Bloomberg is Republican in name only. He's a rhino.
I guess he's technically an independent.
Right, but
these days,
but yeah. We did have 3 terms of Bloomberg. But I think people are sick of Bloomberg, and I think that particularly this last term of his, like things like rent has risen so much that people are ready for a corrective. And I sort of think the middle class people who are, you know, worried about that, they're reacting to that more than Christine Quinn's, you know, sexual preferences. But again, I experience New York differently.
No, go ahead. Sorry.
No, I mean, I walked into this conversation feeling the same way that Noreen said. I mean, I don't support her or like her because of her positions and also because I don't like gay people, but this is my last episode.
Certainly will be.
She's middle of the road / leans, you know, she's too moderate for me. She did not do the right thing on family leave until her arm was completely twisted to get that Gloria Steinem, you know, endorsement. She did not say the right things about stop and frisk until, again, still isn't saying the right things about stop and frisk, although somewhat distancing herself from Bloomberg on that issue, because she sees the tide turning on that. So, you know, and that's whatever. She's not the only one. There are plenty of craven politicians who change their mind all the time. And maybe that's what you're saying, that, like, she's a typical politician. So why is she, with all of her, you know, with the rest of her experience, why is that now putting her behind the eight ball? But, you know, I think it is a strangely boring field of candidates, and she is also quite boring. She's not very eloquent. I can see a wide range of reasons for people to not support her. It also feels like people in New York, I don't know if you guys feel like this, but like aren't quite paying enough attention. It's soon.
Yeah, exactly. That actually is the weirdest thing to me, that I do understand that, you know, especially the Bloomberg thing with the third term, that was a very unpopular view, and I'm one of the people who voted for Bill Thompson in that election, which almost
remember how close?
Bloomberg almost didn't win
that.
And I don't think that was because of any love for Bill Thompson, but because of, you know, anger at his honor. But you know, I just don't, yeah, it's very close, it doesn't feel like it's this election race. It feels very bland, very quiet. But I mean, I can't help but notice that there are these ads that we see on New York television that are just anti-Quinn ads. I don't see anti-anyone else ads.
Paid for by whom?
Well, it's paid for, I mean, it's not that these people are mysterious. Is they're paid for by this group that's led by 3 people, 2 of whom are associated with unions, 1 of whom seems to be an independent person who one of the groups. Has a lot of feelings about the misuse of animals, and one is a woman who has feelings about the misuse of animals and cruelty to animals and just general progressive politics.
We should just say that in New York, carriage horse issues are a big deal.
Right,
right? No, seriously.
It's true.
It's true. And so the carriage horse people, I guess, feel that she's, you know, anti-horse.
Yeah. But they all are. I mean,
yeah,
I think
they all are.
I think people are taking ads out against her because she's the front runner, not because she's... I mean, have you seen any ads that sort of might other her in a really specific way?
Well, I think that those ads do other her.
Okay.
I mean, because she is kind of other compared to... I mean, there's an Asian American, there's an African American in the race, so it's not like she's the only person who isn't, you know,
a white
dude.
And Bill de Blasio is married in an interracial marriage.
Right. And his wife used to be a lesbian too, which, you know, she and his ex-lesbian wife or his... is, I don't know, she's an ex-lesbian technically, but anyway, she's been happily married to her husband for 20 years or something. But she was the one who made what seems to me to be a coded homophobic attack. So, I mean, yeah, it's all very weird and controversial, but I still don't see why, I don't understand why people aren't excited about the first lesbian mayor. I mean,
well,
I do tend to think that what you said at the start, Noreen, is somewhat convincing, but I still there should be a visceral feeling that I expect, and I'm not seeing it.
Well, except there wasn't necessarily a huge. I mean, there was. half the women were, but everyone wasn't excited as a woman about Hillary when she ran. I mean, there was I wasn't excited about her, and a lot of women weren't. I mean, there's a whole, like, kind of women against Hillary, women for Obama thing. I think, like, I don't know if that's about, like, cat scratching, you know.
You people. My goodness.
There was one of my coworkers at the New Republic did a great blog post where he just pulled articles talking about Hillary in 08 and, you know, how she couldn't connect with voters and she was stiff, and pulled the quotes talking about Quinn, and they were indistinguishable. They are talked about in the same way. They're similar, sort of, somewhat similar, you know, public persona in some ways.
But you can see that in two different ways. You can see that as just total sexism, right? Mm-hmm. Or you can see that as, like, they are similar candidates, craven, political, you know, middle of the road, who happen to be women.
And have, you know, certainly in Quinn's case, have dedicated themselves to public service. I mean, yes, she's a Polish, and yes, she can be craven, but, you know, let's give some credit for that. I just feel like she's being under... she's just not getting the credit that she deserves.
If you liked her less, you seem to like her as a candidate. If you mm-hmm. liked her less, but she were still the first lesbian, potentially mm-hmm. the first lesbian mayor of New York City, would you still vote for her?
Unless there were, I mean, in this particular race, yes. But if there was another more charismatic and candidate with better policies, then no, it wouldn't be enough. That alone would not be sufficient to get me to vote
female,
for her.
Like a female gay Mike Bloomberg. Do you vote for that person?
I wouldn't. Well, I don't know. Is she single? I mean, I wouldn't vote for Thatcher, but, know, so it's not enough.
Right.
But
do you feel
know,
like the other
she's
Democrats
liberal
are?
Enough.
Yeah, she's liberal enough.
No, exactly.
Okay. So. All right. Well, we'll soon see. Okay, final topic. In 2011, an Ohio man named Richard Beasley, but going by the name Jack, posted an ad on Craigslist that read, "Wanted, caretaker for farm. Simply watch over a 688-acre patch of hilly farmland and feed a few cows. You get $300 a week and a nice two-bedroom trailer. Someone older and single preferred, but will consider all. Relocation a must. You must have a clean record and be trustworthy. This is a permanent position. The farm is used mainly as a hunting preserve, is overrun with game, has stocked a 3-acre pond, but some beef cattle will be kept. Nearest neighbor is a mile away. The place is secluded and beautiful. It will be a real getaway for the right person. Job of a lifetime." With this ad, Beasley lured three unemployed working-class men to Ohio, where he killed two of them and tried to kill the third. Our very own Hannah Rosen explored the case in this month's Atlantic, and she's calling in from her family road trip with everyone in the car to talk about it with us. Hey, Hannah.
Hi. I'm from the Subaru studio today.
Okay, so we all thought this was a really fantastic piece. As I told you, I missed my stop because I was so engrossed in it. In your reporting, you found many similarities in the lives of Beasley's victims. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, he got it in his head that the perfect victim, he used to prey on prostitutes, but he got it in his head that the perfect victim these days would be a middle-aged, white, unemployed guy. He thought that somehow these were the guys that nobody would come looking for. That was basically his criteria. So he left this farm in order to steal their stuff. So he would say, you know, come be the caretaker, bring your truck full of tools, your motorcycle, you know, whatever you want to bring with you. And he had them come up there, and he just thought, well, you know, these guys were just divorced, like a lot of guys in America. They don't have a job. They'll be desperate for work. And so no one will come looking for them. And that was his idea. So that's how he focused on this kind of victim. So that's what he did, basically.
Did you come to this case because you had already been thinking so much about unemployed men, white working class men, or is it just a coincidence?
Yeah, I mean, I first noticed the case when he was arrested while I was reporting my End of Men book. And, you know, honestly, it could have been a chapter in the book. Like, I went into this thinking, oh, this case weirdly highlights the vulnerability of white working class men. Like, when else in history could a killer decide that middle-aged white men are the most vulnerable people in society? That's like an odd, incongruous thought to have. Although I've since gotten, there's a couple of commenters who said, oh no, there was this famous murder case in, you know, 1943 where somebody killed some white men. So apparently it's not completely unique in history, but it seems like a pretty unusual choice. So that's how I was first drawn to it. And then as I got deeper and deeper into it, what pulled me in was something different, which I began to notice about midway, three quarters of the way into my reporting, was that he was totally wrong about these guys. That, you know, in this part of America where men have stopped being married, people aren't married anymore, well, what arose in its place? Like, something else happens, right? If the traditional order of, like, breadwinner guy, wife, kids breaks down, like, something replaces it. And that was, I thought that's what eventually really drew me into the story, is that kind of humanity. You know, the idea that people replaced, in fact, they had very strong relationships is what I discovered. All of them, all of the victims had really, really strong relationships, unusually strong relationships with a best friend, with the kids that who lived with the wife they were divorced from. And so, in fact, you know, everyone came looking for them right away because, you know, this is sort of the theme that comes late in the story, is that when you don't have a family, you develop these kind of unusual, almost off-kilter bonds with people. In one case, a guy who called his best friend 50 times a day. You know, I mean, do any of you call anybody 50 times a day? Like, that's really, really unusual. So he noticed immediately that he was missing. I mean, the killer was completely wrong. Like, if you talk to someone 50 times a day and then suddenly you don't talk to them at all, you'll pretty much notice in 5 minutes that they're missing. That was the surprise discovery.
That was kind of an odd thing about Jack, though, that in some ways he was so astute and he understood exactly. I mean, that ad is so perfect. He was like, as you say, Hannah, he was kind of setting up this idyllic male life, you know, that everything might have gone to crap in their lives, but here's a lifeline, because not only is it a job, but it's, you know, he put that notion of hunting and being on the land and being able to ride motors. I mean, it just, in some ways, that was, he knew perfectly how to capture people. But at the same time, he didn't understand about the connections. But he also didn't seem to think through the fact that these guys are really down on their luck. They're kind of desperate and they don't have that much. I mean, that one guy, the guy who survived, as I recall, because the gun didn't work when they first tried to shoot him, and so the second shot got him in the elbow, so he survived. But he had some stuff, but the others really didn't have, like, it was, if he was murdering people for their stuff, he was in many times murdering them for almost nothing, right?
Yeah, I mean, I never got to talk to him, and it's really unclear what his motivations were. I think probably with a lot of serial killers, you start out with a kind of clear idea of what you're trying to accomplish. And I've only learned more about him by talking to his accomplice, who was a 16-year-old kid who he'd known all his life. And that's the final irony of the story, that, you know, he missed that these people had these out-of-family connections when he himself had effectively a surrogate son who he'd been the mentor and surrogate father to since the kid was 8 years old, who's the one who helped him do the killings. But I learned more about him because Brogan Rafferty, who's the kid, and I had a lot of letters exchanges, and now, you know, he's 18, he's had, you know, a couple of years to think about what happened. He, in the Q&A that also ran with the Atlantic website, he says, you know, I think he snapped towards the end, and I think, you know, initially his motivation was, you know what he used to do? He used to watch Storage Wars, you know, that show Storage Wars? Mm-hmm. And you know, that's like the largeness of the American imagination. That's like as big as he got. He was like, oh, I can be one of these guys. Like, I can, you know, he figured, like, whatever fits in the back of a flatbed truck or a U-Haul is effectively what would fit in a storage unit. I mean, that's how his imagination works. So whatever they could fit there, he could sell off. So you're right. Like, why wasn't he robbing mansions or something? It seems like much more efficient to rob, you know, some rich lawyer's house in Akron, you know, than to steal bit by bit people's possessions in the back of a truck. But by the end of it, I mean, he'd gone a little crazy. Like, he was, the last guy he killed had nothing. I mean, nothing. Like, his car didn't work. He had borrowed $20. I don't remember if this was in the story, but he had borrowed $20 from his son, who he was going to pay back once he got his first paycheck, and he had $5 of it left because he spent the $15 on cigarettes and dinner, you know, so he really had nothing. So I think, you know, by the end, it just wasn't really holding together anymore.
Hannah, that made me wonder, you write about the family-sized hole that all these people have, and I thought that was a really wonderful phrase. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you felt like the killer had that, or if that was what was missing, and if his relationship with the young man who was his accomplice was genuine or manipulative or some combination.
I think some combination. I feel that's the last puzzle left unfigured out in the story, is what exactly was the nature of their relationship. The kid gave a pretty honest interview about it when he was first arrested. He was going to do a plea bargain. It didn't work out, but he gave a pretty honest interview. And they were, you know, he was 16 years old. He'd known him since he was a little kid. I think it was Richard Beasley, the killer, he practiced out these kinds of relationships throughout his life, these sort of manipulative, paternal, preacher-like relationships. He had them with the prostitutes who lived in this house, who he was supposedly saving from the streets, and then they would curdle, you know, but they'd all start out saying, oh, yeah, he picked me up off the streets, he wanted to be my father, he wanted to save me, and then it would all go south. So I think he did that with a lot of people, like the 16-year-old's sister, his younger half-sister said, oh, yeah, he would come to the church, and he would be our mentor, and, you know, he talked to us like our parents didn't talk to us, and our parents never had time to talk to us, and he was, you know, really great, and he would answer every question, he'd talk about his life experience, he seemed to have all this time, he would give us donuts, and so I think with the kid, his accomplice was the most successful. Like, that's just the way he operated in the world. But with the kid, he had the most effective of those relationships, probably because he'd known him since he was a little kid. And the kid was really interested in church. And Beasley was, I mean, it's very American that way, right? It feels like an American Gothic horror story, like the fact that they met through going to church every Sunday faithfully. And even in there, as they were in the getaway car, in order to not look suspicious when that guy got away, he told Brogan, the kid, you know, tuck in your shirt. He got a shirt from the back, which was his church shirt. I can't remember if this was in the story either. There were too many details to fit, but he said, put on your church shirt, tuck in your shirt, and, you know, brush your hair, because they, in fact, did all the killings on Sundays, which was the day that, you know, for the past 8 years, they had gone to church together every Sunday. So he said, you know, be a church boy now. So who knows? I mean, I don't understand the mind of a psychopath. I don't think the kid is a psychopath. I think the kid just got drawn into something that he couldn't control and didn't know what to do with and just basically got stuck, you know? But the guy was, you know, he was like a psychopath, manipulative, whatever people like that are. I don't know. Maybe one day I'll talk to him.
Did you see any similarities between this case and the Long Island serial killer who we talked about a few weeks ago when we had Bob Kolker on?
Yeah, I mean, I guess except that case is unsolved, so we really don't know anything about it. But yes, I suppose that those women who he wrote about in that case, the kind of working class white women trying to make it, are the female equivalent of the guys in this case, you know, the working class white guys trying to make it. You know, I guess they both give you a window into how much people are struggling. I mean, one of the most heartbreaking things I found, I reproduced one of them in the story, but there's many more. Lots of people answered that Craigslist ad that you read, Allison. You know, more than 100 people answered the ad. So the letters were reproduced by FBI agents once they subpoenaed to Craigslist, and many of them were read in the trial, and they're really sad. I mean, they're very sweet and tender. They're, you know, they're just trying to hold back their desperation. I'm a really good worker. I will do anything. I was raised on a farm, and almost all of them hint back to another life that the person had. So it's like, oh yes, I used to live on a farm, or I've been a construction worker for 30 years until my company closed down. You know, they were all extremely similar. You just see a type repeated over and over again of a person with one kind of, you know, steady, you know, kind of life you hear about in country music and political speeches, and then now they kind of lost that life, fell through their, you know, slipped through their fingers, and they can't quite grab onto another one. So
it's tragic.
Yes, it was very very sad. And the one, you know, one final thing I would say is I would urge, I don't know if readers or you guys, I mean, did you any of you read the interview with Brogan? I'm curious what, if I left having a lot of sympathy for him, but I would be curious to hear what people who read about him thought, like whether you guys have a sense that he had gotten pulled into something out of his control, or you basically had no sympathy for him. I was a little unresolved about that.
I read the letters. I guess in your piece, I had more sympathy for him than after I read the letters. I'm not exactly sure. He didn't say anything really wrong in the letters. It was just so kind of, it felt cold to me.
That's interesting, because I didn't read the letters, but I feel sympathetic to him. I mean, it feels like he's a kid who had a need. This guy seemed like he was helping him, was actually getting into the biggest trouble imaginable. And, you know, it seemed like he was giving him structure and giving him some hope for a better life, and actually was removing any chance of a decent life that he would ever have. but I didn't read the letter, so maybe...
I mean, it's not so stark. Go read them and let me know what you think. But I just something about those letters just sort of twisted a little bit. I don't think he's, you know, like you said, Han, I don't think he's a psychopath and he set out to kill people, but you know...
He did it four times.
Yeah.
the detail that sort of got me was that he didn't want his grandmother's rosary removed.
Right.
And that,
right.
You know, I mean... That just speaks to someone who feels a certain emotional connection with other human beings.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, he's definitely not a psychopath. I mean, he does feel an emotional connection. And one of the great ironies here is that the great mistake he realizes. I mean, I think most people who are in jail think they're innocent or think they've been screwed by the system. That's pretty typical. But the great mistake of his life, he realizes, is failing to see where his family was. Like failing to locate correctly where the family was, you know, having this teenage idea that his dad is Irish and his dad's a single dad and he's pretty tough and really strict. And the kid seems like a fairly sensitive, you know, he was like chubby when he was young and very reserved and didn't have a lot of friends. And, you know, he felt put upon by his father, who was working all the time. He's a machinist and, you know, very strict and had one way of living. And so that turned him off and into the arms of this other guy who was like a jolly Santa Claus looking, you know, always had candy in his pocket and always had a kind word and always had good advice. And now, too late, he's realizing, boy, did I mislocate where the heart is. Like, his letters are always about his grandmother, his father, his grandmother, his father, his pet rabbit, his dog. You know, he's just like desperate yearning for his real family, and his letters is really sad.
Okay, well, it's a terrific piece. We recommend everyone go read it. And Hannah, thanks for calling us, and get home safely.
Thank you. Thank you guys for having me on your show.
It's so awkward.
Sorry.
Okay, bye.
Right.
Bye.
Bye.
Okay, recommendations for the week. June, you're up first.
All right, I have a couple. Fiction and nonfiction. In the nonfiction department, I think we're in this golden age of crime writing and true crime writing. I know that David Hagland also recommended this in the Culture Gabfest, but it's so damn good, I want to recommend it too, which is Taken, Sarah Stillman's piece about civil forfeiture that was in last week's New Yorker, that is just amazing and is another kind of stark example of how stacked the odds are against working class people. When the system wants to screw with you, there's very little that can be done, and it takes some very patient attorneys to fight it. And then the other thing is a piece of nonfiction, which is Broadchurch, which is on BBC America, which is a British show actually from ITV, even though it's on BBC America. But it's just a really gripping and surprising kind of a mystery. But it's kind of also a character piece. It's, I believe, episode 3 will have aired by the time this goes live, but you can catch up. And there are 8 episodes in total, and it's fantastic.
I want to watch that. Okay, Noreen.
I also have 2. One.
It's not allowed.
Well, mine are both tiny. Tiny things you can find on the internet. One is a photo essay on the cut of all the shoes that women keep in their office.
that's so good.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, it's, and they're all very unglamorous. Like, it's a lot of heels, but sort of jumbled under the desk, and then there are flats, and, you know, a lot of women had, like, 10 pairs under their desk, and I usually have maybe 1 pair of shoes, so this made me feel like I'd licensed to keep a bit more of a stack at the office. And then the other thing is someone on YouTube slowed down, you know that song Jolene, the country classic, slowed it down by 25%. And if you Google slow ass Jolene, you will find
with a hyphen between slow and
I
ass.
Don't think there's a hyphen. Okay. There properly should be, but yes. But this musical genius did not put it on there. Anyway, it's just really haunting, and it changes Dolly Parton's voice, and it's just really cool sounding. So it's, slow ass Jolene.
It's an amazing song to begin with, mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. To make it even more haunting is special.
Well, my recommendation is more of an intra-slate plug. But I'm going to recommend a new blog that we've launched for this month on XX called Expecting Better, which is written by Emily Oster, who has a new book out also called Expecting Better, Pregnancy by the Numbers. Basically, she's an economist, and she's applying some economic theories and methods to answering timeless pregnancy questions that other pregnancy books do address, but not in any scientific way. Her current post is about whether or not you should be induced. She had a post about bed rest, which is bullshit. and you should check it out. Again, it's on Slate, and it's called Expecting Better by Emily Oster. So that's it. Please visit our XX Facebook page and let us know what you thought of today's show and what you'd like us to talk about in future podcasts. Thanks to Chris Wade for producing this podcast, and also to Andy Bowers, executive producer of all Slate podcasts, and to our awesome intern, Lori McHugh. Also, just a personal thanks to listeners for humoring my use of the words like and you know. And also on Slate, we have a great defense of like this week. If anyone wants to check it out, by Katie Waldman. It'll make us all sound smarter than you think we are. And also, thank you for opening my mind on a variety of issues and for the hate mail. And with that, I will sign off. Come back in 2 weeks for the next GabFest. Jolene, 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 Jolene. Please don't take him just because you can. Your beauty is beyond compare with flaming locks of auburn hair. For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early, so everyone can go home on time. There's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.